I need to tell you about one of my biggest pet peeves in life that happens, and maybe you can relate, maybe you can't, in which case I'm doing a great job connecting with my audience, so kudos to me right there. One of my biggest pet peeves is when people make a situation that is not about them, all about them. Have you ever had an experience with that? I've been a pastor for about 10 years, and so over the course of time, I have went to a lot of wakes and a lot of funerals. I've officiated like 24 or 25 weddings. And for whatever reason, these big events in life, they always have a way of sometimes bringing out the worst in people. And oftentimes it comes out in that way. A couple years ago, I did a wedding for a couple. Really great couple, really sweet people. And every time I do a wedding, the first question I always ask is, tell me about, like, before we start talking about your ceremony and stuff like that, like, tell me about your family, and are there any, like, weird, you know, things that we should know? And I asked a person this, and they're like, well, how much time you got? Which is, you know, kind of me like, okay, buckle up, you know, let me get myself strapped in here. And so the bride, in this case, went on to tell me about her family and talk about how her parents had been together, and then they split up later on in life, I think when she's around 9 or 10. And since then, mom had stayed single, dad had remarried, and as often happens, remarried to a woman who is quite a bit younger than dad was, and this caused a little bit of consternation in the family flow of things, you know, to where it got to the point where they couldn't be in the room with each other anymore, basically. Like, they were worried about the rehearsal dinner, let alone, like, the actual wedding, you know, and how that's going to go. And I will never forget, a few weird things happened. They had an outdoor wedding, which, just side note, those of you planning a wedding, you're taking your life into your own hands if you plan any element of it outdoors. So don't say I didn't warn you. This is God speaking to you right now. You may want to have a backup plan, okay? The wedding kind of gotten thrown off course by some rain. And so as it happened, both of her parents were going to have to stay in this small little hallway where the bridal party was waiting before they would go on stage as the wedding began. And I will never forget just the look of distress in this bride's eyes on, like, the most wonderful day of her life as she's having to do the horrible balancing act of keeping mom happy, keeping dad happy, keeping them far away from each other. And at some point, I just want to stand up and go, oh my gosh, can you guys just shut up and understand this is not about you right now? Can we, like, please set aside our grievances for, like, I don't know, 20 minutes because you're 60, you know, like, I don't know, like, can we just, like, be adults right now? But because I'm the pastor, I said, hello, you know, like that, you know, like that. I've learned enough to know you shouldn't say that, right? But I was so outraged. I can only imagine if I was the bride in that situation, how I'd feel. Now, here's what I've noticed about my life, and I'm going to venture to guess maybe your life too, is I have this really weird thing that I do where I, without even being told, without being helped to understand, just develop this idea that my life is all about me. And sometimes out of the greatness of my heart, I might for like 2 minutes make it about you, but then it comes back to me, you know? And even if I'm being really honest, a lot of the times when I make my life about you, it often kind of serves that boomerang purpose of actually coming back around to kind of be helpful to me, you know? And I do that, and it makes me a bad person and a terrible Christian, and me and Jesus have had many a conversation over the years about that problem in my life. But here's the other thing I tend to do. As part of that mindset, if you will, I tend to somehow think that I'm kind of the big dog around, right? I think I'm the stuff, you know? And I think that's something that is human nature for all of us to do. Because, I mean, when you look around at the planet, right, who's the people in charge? Well, I mean, it's us, right? You know, like our government, though we may have different thoughts on it sometimes, like our government isn't ruled by like squirrels, right? It's ruled by human beings, right? Like we're the people, you know, we're in charge here, you know, that kind of thing. And the problem is we're really not, right? We're not in charge at all. And the problem is I start thinking I'm big stuff because, you know, I feel like I'm kind of king of my domain and all the stuff I can see, but I'm not really. Because in the grand scheme of things, I'm pretty small. And even when I was 100 pounds heavier in college, even back then, in the grand scheme of things, I was fat, but I was really small still, you know, okay? And it's kind of crazy how we develop that feeling and that attitude in the way that we live our lives. Now, Here in my hands right now, I am holding one of our communion crackers, okay? You probably, I don't know if you get up in the top row, you're probably like, whoa, I don't even know if I believe that or not, right? You know, I asked someone in our first service earlier, I was like, hey, can you see this? He's like, hey, I have an astigmatism, so thanks for making fun of my, you know, inability to see things. I was like, all right, good job, pastoral points right there, you know? And so I hold in my hands a little tiny communion cracker. Now, the way our lives really work is honestly, in comparison to God and in comparison to God's kingdom, we're kind of like the scale of this tiny little communion cracker I hold in my hand in light of like this whole room, right? If this cracker was just like lying on the ground somewhere, something like that, you wouldn't even notice it probably, right? Because it's just so small, it's so infinitesimal. This is the worst comparison ever because if I wanted to be like really true, I should have like some subatomic particle on the end of my finger, right? And we need to expand this room about, you know, a million miles or something like that to capture how small we are in light of how grand, how huge, how big God is. But I miss that. And you miss that. And the penalty that we pay when we miss that is that sometimes we miss the fact that God, because his kingdom is bigger than just me and mine and my, what that means is God will sometimes put the we ahead of me. And I think when we think about that from like a, just a calculating sort of perspective, when we think about that from the perspective of someone who's just living in this world, you know, like when we think about that just kind of, you know, removed from everything that's going on in our lives, I think we can all kind of admit, okay, yeah, that's probably a good way to live. You know, if you've been a part of a team, if you like are on a team at work or at school or something, you know, we all like it when people put the team first instead of themselves first, because we've all been on a team a time or two where people are like, it's all about me, you know, and you're like, oh, wow, yeah, we can't wait to get the me off the team, right? You know, you put the me in team, you know, it's kind of how you feel. But when life happens, it gets challenging because all of us have an it. And what I mean by that is all of us at one point or another have asked this question about, hey, God, why don't you do something about it? And it is different in every season, every time in our lives, but it can range from something to a medical problem, to a marriage problem, to a lack of, you know, hey, God, the it is my dating life right now, and I wish you were more active in that right now, right? The it can be a financial thing. The it can be, hey, God, why do they have so much, and I feel like I don't have anything? The it can be, why do they get into their school, and I am not, you know? Like, why am I, like, relegated to my safety school or whatever, you know? The it can be, hey, why do they get all the fame and notoriety and credit, and I feel like I don't get any, you know? The it can be a number of different things, but when we get kind of locked into this it that affects us, what happens is we all of a sudden just have this strange way of shrinking our perspective to just the size of us. And when we do that, we begin to lose sight of the fact that God will oftentimes put the we, he will put his kingdom ahead of what's just good for me. And I like that when I'm not affected. You know, I like that when I'm in the we that benefits. But when I'm the me that has to maybe set myself aside, that maybe has to endure a little tension, I'm not as big a fan. And so today I want to talk about that. What do we do when it feels like God is late in our lives? And to do so, I want us to look at this story of a family who lived in the first century, and they were like BFFs with Jesus, okay? It was a guy named Lazarus and his two sisters, Mary and Martha. Now, Lazarus and Mary and Martha to Jesus were kind of like people that I hope we all have in our lives, where they were just really great supporters of Jesus and who he was. They were the kind of people that anytime Jesus is traveling through the area, they would make sure to have Jesus over for dinner. They would always, hey, you've always got a bed here. You can stay here as long as you need. We got a home-cooked meal for you. You know, they were those kinds of people, you know, the kinds of people that are just, you know, they want to be encouragers and helpers. They were there to kind of fill you up, those kind of people. So if you would think if anyone had a problem, if anyone had an it that they needed Jesus to deal with, who would be first in line to get some help? You would think it would be, you know, Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And that's where today's story comes in. It comes from this first century document called the Gospel of John, John chapter 11. And in John chapter 11, we read a little bit more about Mary and Martha and Lazarus's story. And so if you have a Bible, feel free to open up and look along. I'm going to read here a few just little reflections I think we can come up with, I think, as we look at this story together. John chapter 11, verse 1. A man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord, on Jesus, and wiped it with her hair. Okay, so this is a Mary we've already met before if you're reading John's gospel here. So the sister sent word to Jesus saying, "Lord, the one you love is sick." Now, I just got to tell you, if your relationship with Jesus, if you can be summoned, Jesus can be summoned for you, and they don't have to say, "Hey, Jesus, Lazarus is sick." But they say, "Hey, Jesus, the one you love is sick," right? That's a more intimate relationship, right? You don't just go around saying, "Oh, hello, Jim, the one I love," unless you're Jim's wife, that's a good thing, But aside from that, this is an intimate, this is a close relationship. So when he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son, so that I may be glorified through it." And then John gives us a little aside here. He says, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, and he kind of puts that in there because what Jesus is going to do next doesn't feel and sound very loving. So when he heard Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was for two more days and then said to his disciples, "Let's go back to Judea." Okay, so Jesus is here, he's teaching, he's doing whatever Jesus stuff he was up to at this moment. And all of a sudden he gets word that one of his best friends is sick. And I imagine, this isn't like a telephone call, okay? This is like they had to actually send a messenger out to tell Jesus what's happening. And from what we know, this guy or girl had to journey about 2 days worth to go find Jesus and tell him Lazarus was sick. And I imagine that the response that everyone expected from Jesus was, "Oh my gosh, my best friend is sick. I should go home and be with them right now." Like, they kind of expected that they were going to be bringing Jesus back with them, and then they weren't, right? Like, you can kind of imagine when the messenger shows back up at the old family homestead, and they're like, "Where's Jesus?" And he said, "We should just go along without him, I guess." Are you kidding me? Right, because Lazarus is sitting at home, and you got to remember, this is the first century AD, folks, right? He is not sitting at home with an IV and morphine to help with his pain, right? He is sitting at home. He is suffering. People are worried, okay? This is a medical environment. When you read in your history books about the 18th century and people use leeches to suck bad blood, that was an improvement from the medical care Lazarus would be receiving at this point in time, okay? This is not a simple circumstance that Lazarus is going through right now, okay? He is probably in a lot of pain. He's experiencing a lot of turmoil. And Jesus' response is, "I want us to wait. I want us to take a breather here for a second." Because Jesus wants to create a new category for his audience and for us. And this goes in the category, I think, of things that we learn that are true and helpful to know about Jesus, but may not feel emotionally satisfying about Jesus. And the category that Jesus is trying to create for us is quite simply this, a category where God's kingdom is greater than my comfort. And that is not a very pleasant truth I love hearing about. I love it when God places his kingdom ahead of my comfort. Please do it again, Lord, that kind of thing. I do not enjoy that, okay? That's human. That's natural. That's normal. But what Jesus is trying to help us see is, hey, guys, in your life, in my life, sometimes the bigger thing God wants to accomplish is going to take precedence over my comfort level. And in Lazarus and his family's case, that comfort level wasn't just I might have to meet someone I don't know. I might have to make small talk. Oh, my God. Do I text? Do I not? What's the etiquette in this situation? No, this is sickness. This is death. This is real tough stuff. And Jesus wants to create a category that says, hey, sometimes to help connect people to me, to draw people's attention to myself, I am willing to sacrifice your comfort in the here and now so that more people might be drawn to the truth about me and about my kingdom later on. And so the story continues with that little happy note. So then the disciples get involved. And they say, but Rabbi, a short while ago, the Jews there in Bethany, where Lazarus is, just outside of Jerusalem, well, they tried to stone you, and you're going back. And what the disciples, they aren't really concerned about Jesus. What the disciples are really saying is, hey, Jesus, sometimes when people get mad at you, they throw stones at you, and they miss you, and they hit us, and it kind of hurts. And so we would really like to not go back there if we could avoid that, please. You know, so, hey, maybe we should just stay here. Can we pray for Lazarus? You know, can we take up a love offering for Lazarus? You know, can we do something like that for Lazarus? So Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble because they see by this world's light. It is when they walk at night when they stumble because they have no light. And what Jesus is saying, surely his disciples are like losing it right now, is guys, I'm only going to be in this world a little bit longer. And while I'm in this world, I am the light of the world. And you should want to follow what I do because soon I am not going to be around anymore and you're going to be kind of lost in the dark. I'm trying to teach you a lesson right now while I'm here so that when I'm gone, you can understand a little bit about how God has created you and how God has created this world to work. And so Jesus continues on. So after he said this, he went on to tell them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to wake him up. His disciples replied, Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better. Jesus, I don't know if you knew this or not, but like when people sleep, it's good for them. Yeah, they gave Jesus more information. They thought Jesus had been speaking of Lazarus's death, but his disciples thought he had meant natural sleep. So then Jesus does that thing. Parents, you probably understand this. When you're trying to like talk to your kid and they just aren't getting it, and you're like, look, Goldie is dead. You know, like that's kind of what I imagine Jesus does. Because it says, then he told him plainly, Lazarus is dead, and for your sake, I am glad I wasn't there so that you may believe. Let us go to him now. And then Thomas, one of Jesus' disciples, also called Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, well, guys, let us go too that we may die with him. You know, like nice little Eeyore thing, like, well, Lazarus is dead. Jesus is going to be dead. We're going to be dead. Man, I'm really glad I opted in for this, aren't you? You know, so if you ever feel Eeyore as you follow Jesus, you know, one of his disciples was too, so you're in good company. So on his arrival, Jesus found Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary, Lazarus' sisters, to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. Why do you think Mary stayed at home? She was, yeah, that's right. She was mad, okay? She was ticked off. She was angry because in her mind, she's thinking, Jesus, you could have, you should have, I would have, you didn't. And so Jesus, now my brother's dead. We're sad. We feel like we've been punched in the gut. We thought that you were this son of God who is going to do these amazing things and who surely was not going to let such a terrible thing happen to my brother, happen to our family. And now we're here. We've got this funeral. And now you have the nerve to show up 4 days late. You know, you didn't come. You didn't try to help us. You didn't send word. You didn't do anything. What's up, Jesus? And so she stays at home. So Jesus starts to diffuse things with Martha, the other sister. So Martha runs out to Jesus, and she begins this conversation in a way that, you know, is not exactly very fun. She says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Oh, good to see you too, Martha. Pleasure to meet you. Yeah, thanks for coming. But I know even now God will give you whatever you ask. And Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha answered, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. You see, Jesus is talking to Martha, and she's kind of hearing that thing. You know, we all say at funerals and stuff like, oh, they're in a better place. Oh, yeah. Like those kind of just comforting phrases because you don't really know what to say. I'm sorry for your loss, all that kind of stuff, right? That's the plane that Martha's operating on. Jesus has got something way different in mind. And Jesus said to her, Martha, I'm the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. And then Jesus has a question for her. Do you believe this? Do you have confidence in this? Do you trust what I'm saying to you? And Martha, I imagine half out of exasperation and just grief. If you've ever been grieving a loss of someone you love, right? You just know that feeling when you get to the funeral and you're worn out. You're spent. And Martha looks at Jesus and says, "Yes, Lord. I believe you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who's come into the world." And so Jesus sends Martha back and he says, "Bring Mary out here," you know. And I imagine if I'm Jesus, you know, anytime I have to have a hard conversation with someone, I always like do that. You know, okay, I like listen to Eye of the Tiger, you know, I got to get myself amped up or something. Yeah, I had this conversation. So then Mary comes out. And apparently she and Martha had had a conversation about how they were going to talk to Jesus because she literally asked the same question. When Mary reached the place Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and asked, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died," which Jesus is like, "I just had this conversation, actually. Let's do this again." But when Jesus saw her weeping, and he saw the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" "Come and see, Lord," they replied. Jesus wept. And then the Jews replied and they said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" Right? They asked the same question that we do. Jesus, why there and not here? Jesus, why them and not us? Jesus, why this and not that? There are a lot of different situations represented in this room today and you know, that require a lot of pastoral concern and sympathy and empathy. And I'm sure if we could sit across the table and have coffee with one another or something, you told me, "Man, what you're going through," I'm sure my response would be, "Wow, I'm very sorry for that." But I need you to hear this truth this morning. Prioritizing the kingdom doesn't mean that Jesus lacks compassion. Jesus does not stroll into Bethany saying, "What are you guys crying about? What are you guys all worked up about? Like, I'm here, you know, like, my thing, you know?" Jesus doesn't walk in and get angry. Jesus doesn't walk in and get perturbed. Right? Jesus is a big boy, and he understands that, you know, hey, you might be mad at me sometimes, right? And I can handle that. And Jesus doesn't look at our world when we cry, when we experience bad stuff, when we are in pain, when we are suffering, when we are going through just the ringer. He doesn't look at our world and go, "Well, you know, rub some dirt in it." You know, he has compassion. He stands beside us when we suffer. The same Jesus who stands beside you when you walk through life and life is going great is the same Jesus who stands beside you when life is terrible and things are hard and you don't know what's going on. The same Jesus that wept at Lazarus' tomb because he saw a friend and a beloved man die is the same Jesus who stands at our side when we're in the doctor's office and we get the news we didn't want, when we get the phone call that tells us about that family member that passed away, when we hear the word "no" yet again, when that person we love and pray for and care about fell off the wagon again. Right? Jesus' seeming lack of response in the moment does not mean he lacks compassion. Oftentimes, as I think we see in the story, it means that there might be something bigger at play beyond the scope of me. And so the story finishes up, and Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. And it was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. And Jesus says, "Take away the stone," which just imagine yourself at a funeral and someone says, "Okay, open up Bill's casket." You're like, "Well, okay, I don't know who invited you. I don't know what you're doing here. We're going to leave that closed, okay? This is not, you know, something we normally do." And Jesus says, no. Roll away the tomb, or roll away the stone. "But Lord," Martha, the sister of the dead man, says, "by this time, there is a bad odor, for he has been there for 4 days," right? She's kind of twisting the knife, like, "Hey, Jesus, this guy is dead. You probably don't remember because you weren't here to see it, but he's been dead for a while now," okay? And Jesus says, "Didn't I tell you that if you believe, if you'll express confidence in me, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. And then Jesus said, and this is like one of my favorite prayers Jesus ever prays, he says, "Father, I thank you that you've heard me, and I know you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing there, that you might that they might believe you have sent me, right? Jesus prays this prayer, and the purpose of the prayer is essentially to say, God, I'm really only praying this prayer so people can know that what I'm about to do isn't just me, but it's also you working through me. And I just want to make sure to draw glory and attention and credit to you, not just to me. Like, Jesus didn't need, he didn't need any extra help from God to do this. Like, he's the Son of God, right? He can take care of this. He just wanted to connect people to Jesus. I think that's so great. Yeah, it's kind of like Jesus, like, drop the mic prayer right there, you know? And then he finishes, and after he'd said this, Jesus called out in a loud voice, and he says, Lazarus, come out. And the dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. And then Jesus says to them, take off the grave clothes and let him go. And you know why I believe that this event actually happened is because that little detail, if you were ever at a funeral and someone rose up out of the grave and started walking toward you, I'm not going anywhere near that guy until someone says, it's okay, guys. You can help him out. You know, I love that. And the story ends with John recording for us. Many of the Jews who come to visit Mary and saw what Jesus did believed in him. I'll bet they did. You know, I'll bet that was a sight to behold, right? So what do we know when we experience an it? Why doesn't God fix it, whatever it is, for you? I want to give you just a few kind of guideposts to hang on to as we finish here today. Sometimes God doesn't fix it right away because he has a bigger purpose. In this whole story, if I'm sitting in Mary or Martha or Lazarus's shoes, you know what I'm thinking? I want Lazarus to get better, right? And that is a perfectly wonderful and good thing to want and desire, you know? But Jesus had something bigger in mind. Jesus' goal wasn't just to give Lazarus life. Jesus' goal was to help the thousands or hundreds or however many people that were gathered on that day to experience eternal life because they saw what he did to Lazarus that day. And that is something that would not have happened had Jesus responded in the way that we all expected and hoped and wished that he would. This is a really tough truth for us to hear, but it's one that is so important. When I walk through painful times in my life, I get shrunk down to the size of me. I get shrunk down to the size of my problem, and I get shrunk down to the size of whatever it is, the challenge that I face. And what happens is I lose sight of the fact that, man, compared to the scope of God's kingdom and what he is trying to do in this world, I'm just one tiny little grain of rice. I'm one little grain of sand. You know, I'm one little cracker, you know, in the grand scheme of what he is doing. And I shouldn't be surprised when God has a purpose that goes beyond me using information I don't know and hindsight I don't have to do something I didn't expect. When you walk through something that is painful, when you walk through something where it feels like God might be late, one of the best questions that we can ask is, what might the bigger purpose be that Jesus is trying to accomplish here? Second thing to think about. Sometimes God doesn't fix it because he has a better plan. Mary and Martha and Lazarus' plan was, I want Lazarus to get better. Jesus' plan was, I want Lazarus to rise from the dead. Which one do you think is more impressive, you know? I don't need to look any farther than my own life to think about how true this is. I could give you situation where I feel like, man, God's plan for my life was so much better than mine. And I am so glad that God did not answer all the prayers I prayed in my life when I prayed them, because my life would probably be pretty screwed up right now. One of the things I give thanks to God for every day is, man, my marriage. And I know my wife knows this, and I want you to know this too. I'm not married to the person I ever would have expected, unless you think that's weird. I'm sure my wife would tell you, yeah, likewise for me, right? Yeah, like, we're making fun of some couple we know that's like interracial dating or whatever, and we're like, oh, wow, I can't believe he's dating her. And my wife looked at me and said, I can't believe you're dating me. Like, you're the whitest guy I know, you know, or whatever. Like, this is so ridiculous, yeah? And so, Like, I just, every day, I just got to laugh because I think about all the times in my 20s where I was praying, oh, God, please help her say yes. Help her say yes. Oh, please, Lord, you know. And now I look back and I go, man, what, like, how silly, right? Like how, like, I didn't even know what I was praying about, right? I look at my life now, I'm so grateful that God had a bigger and better plan for my life than what I could have imagined that he had in store. The Apostle Paul, in one of his letters in the first century, he says that we have a God who does immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine. And I really like that when it's on like a Pinterest board somewhere online. But when I'm having to live that out and when I'm having to live out a bunch of no's so that I can get to the amazing yes that God has in store for me, I kind of miss that. And I'm willing to settle, okay? It doesn't take very much pain for my standards to go from here down to here really, really quickly, right? And thank goodness God doesn't capitulate to my demands all the time. Because oftentimes he has a better plan in store than what I can imagine. I just haven't seen it yet. And that's not just true about my life. And that's not just going to be true about the first 30 years of my life. And now, you know, we've hit the crux point. Now it's all downhill from here, you know. That is going to be true every day of your life, and do not let the present darkness you live in stop you from remembering and being reminded of that. Final thing. Why doesn't God fix it? And this is kind of a hard one. Sometimes God doesn't fix it because he is building faith. Faith, as we've talked about, and I know I've hit this note a lot with our church here the past several weeks, but humor me again. Faith is not like a set of religious beliefs. Faith is not, when the Bible talks about it at least, it's not like some bullet list we put on a wall of all the things that we believe about Jesus or we believe about God or we believe about, you know, you name it, okay? Faith, when the Bible speaks about, when Jesus talks to us about it, faith is this confidence, this assurance, this trust that we have in God, our Heavenly Father, that allows us to keep taking a next step even when we aren't entirely sure where that's going to lead. And I don't really mind exercising much faith when it's stuff where it's like, oh, if this doesn't work out or if this messes up or if this, you know, goes sideways somehow, like, it's no big deal, you know, like I can handle that, right? The problem is that's usually not what builds faith. What builds faith is when we are brought to a place where we are beyond our abilities. And we aren't just at the end of the rope. We left the rope back about a couple miles ago, okay? Right? Because we don't build faith in the peaks of life oftentimes. We build faith when we walk through the valleys. And what's kind of critical is if we're going to put the kingdom of God first in our life, as Jesus invites us to, right? When he said, seek first the kingdom, and all these things will be added to you as well. If we're going to put the kingdom first, what that means is God's kingdom is not going to move forward in and through my life and in and through our church and into this world without us being willing to leave our comfort behind so that we can express our confidence in God for what is ahead. And that requires courage. That requires guts. That requires a kind of faith that oftentimes only gets built in the waiting rooms of life. Peppered all throughout this story, we see that little word, believe. And we see Jesus kind of bring things to a head at the end when he says, hey, didn't I tell you? If you will believe, man, you will see the glory of God. And what's so crazy to me is Jesus often links our ability to express our trust in him with our ability to experience and see him do these amazing things that only God can do. But we've got to exercise the faith to see it. So why doesn't God fix it? Sometimes it's because he's got, you know, a bigger purpose at play. Sometimes it's because he's got a better plan in store. I guarantee you all the time it's because he wants to build faith in the meantime. We're going to sing one last song together this morning, and we're going to sing this song. It's not so much a song that we want you to sing along with. I mean, I'm not going to stop you if you know, want to or anything. But it's more a song, I think, to help us reflect on that final truth. To take courage when we find ourselves in seasons of waiting. And feel free to just kind of recline in your chair for the next 3 or 4 minutes and listen to the words of this song. Let those kind of wash over you and kind of impact you. Maybe this is an opportunity for you to pray about a particular situation you are walking through right now. It's my hope that we might find courage and that we might build faith in the waiting. Let me pray for us to do that. Jesus, I thank you so much for your word that points us to the truth that we can know and believe and expect about you. And Jesus, it's my prayer that for those of us who are walking through the waiting room today, God, give us the courage to know, to trust, to follow you. Jesus, give us the courage to rely on you. Jesus, we know that you are in charge of all things. And Jesus, we know that time spent waiting on you is never time wasted. God, for the people in this room walking through different stuff this morning, help us take courage. Help us see the character of Jesus formed in us through the waiting. We pray this in your perfect and sovereign name.